can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Now, Don, many times, not many times, we're out of our depth when we interview people. We've had some very interesting people we've interviewed. Usually we have a vague idea what we're talking about, but I make no apology for the fact that I have no idea what I'm talking about to this gentleman I'm about to introduce, because I was a part of a group of people that went up to a clinic, a medical facility up in Ballarat. I went with Lady Primrose Potter, who was going to be a an ambassador for this clinic up there, and I met some extraordinary people who are into cancer research and preeminent cancer research in the world. And this is up in Ballarat, and you think, what is going on in Ballarat that we don't know about? Well, I was absolutely gobsmacked. Yes, Don?
Can I ask a question? Why would they ask you?
They asked, that's a good question, I like it. I have known Lady Primrose Potter only just as...
She went to Georgia.
She's
grammar.
90 years old. And she was Sir Ian Potter's wife, but she is Primrose Potter in her own right. And she is a remarkable woman, and they asked her, the clinic up there, I think it's called a clinic anyhow, we'll just find that out in a minute, asked her to be an ambassador for this groundbreaking research.
You said that, but why were you up there?
I drove Lady Primrose Potter up in the car.
Oh, so you were her driver in your spare time. What car did you go in? The Lamborghini,
Don,
the Mustang,
Don,
the Boss Mustang,
Don,
I mean the E-Type.
We've got a professor has come down from Ballarat. What matter what car I drove Primrose Potter up in? I'm trying to introduce this eminent person, Don. And his name is Professor George Kanarakis. Kanarakis. And I could read out what he is. It's been pointless me reading this out. He's an MBBS, which is a Medical Bachelor of Surgery. I don't know what the other B means. He's a Bachelor of Medical Science. It goes on and on. If you want to Google who George Kanarakis is, Professor, it goes on and on. He is an eminent person, and he is at the forefront, I think, of trying to develop or identify a protein which might be the generic cause of all cancers throughout the world. I think that's a ham-fisted way of introducing him. We are going to try and ask him some sensible questions, and he's going to fill the rest in because he is a star. Professor George Kanarakis, thank you very much for coming down. Did I get any of that right or not?
Most of it, Sam. That was very good. Don, thank you.
Thanks, George.
His wife, Trudy, is sitting next to you, Don. So,
who is the daughter of Arthur Martin. Do you know who Arthur Martin is?
Arthur, no, I don't.
What a very prominent stall gift winner. Did you realise that?
Don, I didn't. But
you're floored by that useless piece of information.
In the process of telling you what car I drove Lady Primrose Potter up in, and what Trudy Martin's father was, and how she knows you, let's speak to the professor, eh? That's why he's here. Now, Professor, I felt really humble. Don and I are just dribblers in the overall world of anything that's going around. You are someone who is actually doing something really important in the promotion of world health. I was gobsmacked when I saw that that facility up in Ballarat. Tell me who you are and what you are doing.
So, Sam, I'm the honorary director of the Fiona Elsie Cancer Research Institute, which is named after a patient of mine who had Ewing sarcoma that we'll talk about in a sec. She was a teenager when she died, and she wished to have a research set up in Ballarat because she came from Ballarat, and I was actually travelling from Ballarat to Melbourne to look after her in Melbourne, but we'll go into that in a sec. I think the most important thing is that the institute is a community-funded institute. There's no government funding for the institute, and we have 15 scientists and 5 PhD students at the moment that are actually working on various aspects of different cancers, but with one goal. We have one theme in mind, and that is looking for what I call barcode proteins, which are proteins that you alluded to, which are probably only present in cancers that are aggressive and are likely to cause the death of the patient by spreading to other organs.
There's so many questions. So are you saying if you can identify this one particular protein that is generic or common in all cancers, you will be able to, or your team or whoever will be able to, find a cure for every cancer? Or is that
so that's
not quite
right?
Go
back one step. It's probably more than one protein. We think that there's a group of proteins, and we have called them the barcode proteins because in my way of thinking, it's similar to a barcode on every cancer. So every individual cancer is probably stamped with a group of proteins that are present on the surface of the cancer cell that causes the immune system to not see it, in other words, to evade the immune system. And that is specific for cancers that are then become aggressive. Now, you probably understand that there are patients who live with their cancer for a long time, right? So there are patients with various leukemias who have no symptoms, who have cancer in them for 20 or 30 years and have no symptoms. There are patients with...
Didn't know that. So. Yeah.
Well, there's something that you've learned. And there's other patients...
There'll be plenty I've learned by the time we've finished this discussion.
And there's other patients with various cancers, such as early stage prostate cancer and early stage other cancers that... like lymphomas, for instance, that don't have any symptoms, and we often don't treat those patients. They have the cancers there. One of the interesting concepts has been that these are cancers that are different. Yeah.
Don. George, can I ask a question that's often fascinating?
Don was flicking his fingers at me.
Yes.
And not at you, Professor. Yeah.
George, can I ask you a question which has often fascinated me about cancer? As a boy growing up, we never heard about cancer. When did cancer become... cancer as we know it now, and was it around in days gone by when people just died for them? They called it old age.
Yes, cancer's been around for a long, long time. As you know, in the mummies in Egypt, there are mummies that had breast cancer, for instance, that were shown to. So we knew that cancer's been around for a very long time. I think in the medieval ages and before the Industrial Revolution, preventative health measures came in to allow people to live longer, for instance, the average person didn't live that long to be able to develop cancer. When they did develop cancer, it was probably put down to something else. So cancer's been around for ever since humans have been around, I suspect.
So when did it become recognised?
Look, I think as a disease in its own right, it was recognised in the 19th century as tumours that had spread, and then people started using radiation therapy and surgery as the first way of treating cancers. And then, of course, chemotherapy came into its own for in the 1940s and 50s. So that was when, accidentally, it was an interesting story how chemotherapy came to be used it was only been used since about 1950s, just after the war. There was an explosion on a ship that had a gas, mustard gas in it, and caused a drop in the blood counts of the soldiers around it. And so somebody thought, well, if it caused a drop in the white cells, maybe we can use it to treat for certain types of situations where there's an increase in number of these cells.
So they used mustard gas initially?
It was a form of nitrogen mustard, yeah. So it was one of the first chemotherapy drugs used.
So Professor, I'd like to call you the Professor, George. You're by... You're an oncologist?
I'm an oncologist. Not a urologist. And a hematologist. So I'm one of
the... So you have a practice or a that, mm-hmm. but and you do this on a voluntary basis, which yes. this has absolutely staggered me. And for the government not to fund what I saw up in Ballarat is extraordinary.
Well, explain what it is, because I'm a layman. Well, what is it, a laboratory? Is it a factory?
So,
is it connected to the hospital?
I'll just tell you very quickly what I thought it was. I walked in there and there is machinery and... There is machinery and things that test whatever worth millions of dollars that are donated. I'm happy to mention. I can mention one of the footballers who donated,
absolutely.
Stuart Gull and his wife.
Gully is a very successful businessman in Ballarat who's done a
Stuart
lot of.
Stuart and Sue Gull donated funds to buy a machine that cost $1 million, but they donated $500,000, didn't they?
It was $500,000, and they donated a fair bit of that.
There's machinery in there
Is it connected to the hospital?
No. To just to explain to you, Don, it's a non-government organisation. It's a private research facility run by a board, a governance board. We rent our space in the Technology Park, which is part of Federation University. So we rent part of that space and converted it to laboratories and office area. So we pay rent.
So you're connected to the University of Ballarat, in other words?
No, Federation University is affiliated with us as an affiliated institute, but we have no direct dealings with them. We rent space from them.
And there was a group of brilliant people who are your offsiders, who
yes.
do research in various different aspects of what I was looking at, and they either get paid very little or I'm not sure who funds them, but they
are research salaries
dedicated people, dedicated people who are actually contributing, unlike us, Don, to the well-being of the world. And it was eye-opening. And how up in Ballarat you are... probably well known around. Would it be well known around the world for what you're doing,
do you liaise
with your peers?
Yes, we do, and we have collaborations with various groups overseas. In New York, at the Albert Einstein Medical Center, we have a collaborator, Professor Jabinski, who works with us on various aspects of using a new way of treating ovarian cancer, for instance, and so we collaborate with him. We have a collaboration in Stockholm with the Karolinska Institute with Professor Jan-Inka Henta to looking at a condition called histiocytosis that we are world-renowned in that area. This laboratory in Ballarat is one of the world-renowned areas of research in histiocytosis.
In Ballarat. It's amazing. No one knows this. I didn't know
maybe you've covered it, but why Ballarat?
Why Ballarat? Because I love to live there and work there.
So Don...
And it's related to Trudy, who was born there. She was born in Ballarat. We were, to tell you the story in a nutshell, I've met Trudy in Melbourne and we got married, and we got married actually at Trudy's old school, Loreto College.
Yep.
At the chapel there. So we got married there in 1983. I was a paediatric oncologist, hematologist at that time at the Children's Hospital in Melbourne. I did my PhD at the Walter and Liza Hall with Don Metcalf's group, and then when I finished my PhD, I was still working at the Children's, and then we went to Boston to Harvard University at the Dana Farber Cancer Institute for a few years. That was in 88 and 89. And when I was looking to come back to Australia for a job, we went to various places around Australia to look, and in the end I decided in Melbourne to come back to the Children's Hospital in Melbourne and as head of cancer research in 1990. So we had a house that we had in East Doncaster that was rented out, and we couldn't get our house back in time, so we had to spend some time in Ballarat visiting Molly, which is Arthur's wife, who was a widow, of course, and we spent some time with her, and we had a three-year-old son, Josh, at that stage. And so we stayed there over Christmas, and then I went to a New Year's Eve party there, and one of the guys there was commuting by train to Melbourne and said, you know, I commute by train and it takes 2 hours each way, but it was nice and doable, and so I thought I'd do the same thing.
So you set this you personally set this clinic, is it called, or a research?
No, it's a research institute. Research
institute.
It came after a little while.
You set this up yourself, and
with the aid of the community. Yes,
yes, of course.
The community being the Ballarat
and the region. Yes.
The region around Ballarat.
Well, it all started with Fiona, of course. So Fiona Elsie was a patient of mine who I was looking after. She lived in Ballarat, and I lived in Ballarat. We were commuting. We bought a house in Ballarat, so I commuted from Ballarat to Melbourne each day, and she went to have treatment for a condition called Ewing sarcoma, which is a cancer of the nerve system that originated from her bones. And she survived 18 months, almost 20 months actually. During the early stages, she responded to treatment, and then later on, she unfortunately had spread through her body, and she ended up having palliative treatment, which means she was no longer able to receive treatment, and she ended up remaining at home. And one of the problems was we had no hospice at that stage.
Yep.
And I used to bring it was hard to get morphine for cancer patients, especially when they weren't in the same hospital. So I needed to get an esky with the morphine each night and bring it back on the train and give it and take it to her home so that the nurses can administer the morphine, etc., for her. And that's how I got to know her extra well as the family, Gail and Greg Elsie. And one night, in one of those lucid phases, she sort of turned around and said, while her mother was there, Gail, she said, George, I want you to promise one day you're going to set up a...
On her deathbed, yes. She asked you, and you have upheld her wish and promise, and that's how this started. I can't tell you how impressive the facility and George is. It is extraordinary, Don. You've got to go and see. There is millions of dollars worth of equipment there that's on the cutting edge of trying to find a cure for
So how much does this cost, cancer, George, to run?
So the institute costs about $1.8 million a year to run at the current.
And that comes through donations and community.
It comes through philanthropy and donations, yes. So, and we have a few grants that we've applied for overseas and got some of the histiocytosis grants. We've been successful at a few grants, but to get the really top-end grants like the NH and MRC grants, for instance, the number of grants that should have been funded this year, apparently 8.5% of all the recommended grants were only able to be funded this year for research in Australia. So that's how competitive it is to get NH and MRC funding. So for us to achieve what we've achieved, which is to build up a group of very solid postdoctoral fellows, which are post-PhDs, and senior scientists, and attract them to Ballarat, which... I haven't had any problem attracting them to Ballarat. They will want to come.
God, there's something wrong with that. That's the coldest place on earth.
But, you know, we're warm in other ways, Don.
Night. I've
climate-controlled in the laboratory.
I broke down in my truck at Ballarat. It's the worst sleep I have ever had in the middle of winter.
Yeah, well, you need to be in a nice warm room. Well, I came from Boston where we had two blizzards, and when I came to Ballarat and had a winter in Ballarat, I thought it was nothing. So I said to Trudy, you know, Trudy was in Boston with me, and she knows how difficult it is to walk around in Boston during a blizzard, and when you're actually having painful breaths when you're breathing and have icicles from your nose.
Really?
That's how cold it really got. So that never got like that in Ballarat.
So, Doc, Professor... the talented men and women who work with you, I remember asking you a very naive question. How do you start to research? Do you get a drop of blood, put it on under a microscope and work out?
Okay.
How in God's name do you try and find a cure for cancer or find this elusive number or single protein that you're after? And you say that will be the panacea to ending cancer?
Well,
sort of.
It's sort of, because we're on the way there with various ways for the immune system to attack cancer, right? So we now have what's called checkpoint inhibitors that allow immune cells to overreact and try and attack cancer cells. but that's not specific for that particular cancer and doesn't always cure the cancers. So one of the things that we are looking at, which is a bit different, and you asked the question, how do we do research? Well, what I was fascinated about as a clinician, and of course I converted to adult oncology and hematology, haven't heard the other story, which was that I used to travel down to the Children's for 6.5 years and commuted there running cancer research. And then when after Fiona died and her mother Gail bumped into me with the first inaugural Vice Chancellor of Ballarat University, then it was David James, we were at a show at Her Majesty's, and when we were walking out, Gail said, oh, you remember you made a promise to my daughter yep. that you'll set it up, and Professor James is now going to start at the university, and he never had any biological research going on at Ballarat University at that stage, and so he recommended going to St John of God Hospital, which so I went to see the nuns of St John of God Hospital and had a business meeting with them, which was actually in the chapel. And they went and prayed. And
yes,
and I thought we were going to have the business meeting after that.
And that was it.
That was it.
And yeah, they said we're speaking to a higher authority and that's good enough for us.
We'll pray for you to come up and I'm sure everything will be fine. And, they said that we came from Ireland originally and set up this hospital. I said, not with any funding from anywhere, but government, community support. So they actually set it up.
So when was this initially set up?
So the Fiona Elsie Cancer Research Laboratory was set up in the paint shed, a disused paint shed of the boiler house at St John of God Hospital in February 1998 was the first little area that I was able to.
And so you've been going for that period of time.
Correct.
How close are you, or how far down the track are you in discovering this protein?
Good question.
Proteins. We think that, we're well in the way. I can explain to you how we got there. We basically were fascinated by a group of patients who had a large amount of tumour in them and they seemed to be well. So when I
seem to be well,
in other
words, you said everyone has tumour or cancer in
We have cancer cells intermittently and our immune system comes and mops it up, right? But these patients would walk around with, you know, a quarter of a kilogram, a half a kilogram of tumour circulating in their body each second. Now, and they felt perfectly well. They've had it for 20 years. These are called chronic lymphocytic leukemia patients. And you only pick it up because you just pick up a routine blood test, but they don't feel unwell. And so when some of these patients have got high white cell counts but have no treatment.
Sorry. Could be someone calling from the research centre.
Yes, it could be.
Yeah, it's okay.
But and so I've been fascinated with these patients, and so we've been collecting blood from these patients, which has the immune system cells in there, as well as the leukemia cells. And we've been collecting them every 6 months. These patients have been great. There's been 160 of them that I've had over the years, and they've been giving us blood every 6 months. When we were able to work out a technology of how we can, and what happened, to answer your question, Don, some of those patients then got the disease. In other words, they developed symptoms. They had enlarged glands, liver and spleen were enlarged. Their normal blood counts dropped, and they then needed treatment. So those ones we had before and after that happened, right? So we had like cells before they became symptomatic and cells after they became symptomatic.
So they're voluntary trial patients.
They were part of our tissue banking, which is one of the major things that we've set up in the Institute. We have over 40,000 samples now in the Institute over the 23 years since we've set it up.
So at the research...
Hang on, I'm on a track here.
Yeah, okay. So when these patients, we had about 10 or 11 patients now that had progressed to disease that we've been following up for years. And we were able to extract the genetic material that led to the identification of all proteins in those cells. And that's called producing a library, a RNA library. We were then able to send that to the States and form what's called a phage library. That phage library are little particles that infect bacteria, E. coli, specifically attach to bacteria and supposedly infect bacteria.
Right.
And so one of the interesting parts of all this is that the phage that, we used is able to have a little bit of the protein cut up. So the proteins are cut up into smaller bits. Each smaller bit goes into one of these phages. And so one protein may have 20 of these particles put into various phages. Those phages also are engineered in a way that they recognise the protein in there and are able to produce an antibody or antibody to that part of the protein. That means that that antibody is on the surface of the phage, and that phage is then able to attach onto a for instance, a cell onto the leukemic cells.
How do you establish? How do you go about? Just how do you identify all
Stuart Gull's machine that was able to purchase for us, the cell sorter.
Ah, the cell sorter. I got the tissue mixer. That's a cell sorter.
It's a cell sorter. that cell sorter is able to individually identify one cell at a time, and you're allowed to attach one phage onto the cell, and any phages that attach onto the surface of the diseased patient's cells, you can actually isolate and put them aside.
Right, okay.
Okay, and you can drag out, and the main benefit of all this is that you can get rid of all the background noise of thousands and thousands of proteins that were already there.
Mm.
And what we do is we do what's called panning, right? Just like you pan for gold, you actually pan to get rid of everything that attaches onto the patients.
With one protein.
Or one or 10 or 20 or whatever it is, the number that we don't know yet. But one of the things that we do is we pan. So we pan all the phages, all our phage library is panned onto the well cells.
How long does this take?
It's taken us 3 years to produce it, and then we're in the process of now identifying the positive phages now. So we actually have found positive phages.
And Trudy, it doesn't matter if it's ringing. Whose phone is that? It's yours, Don. What, Don, for God's sake, man. Don't worry about it, Trudy. He does this every week. The phone goes off. I tell him to put it on silent. Yeah. Sorry, Doc. Professor.
So in answer to your question, which is a good question, is how do we pick these really rare proteins that are probably hard to pick up and very, very small in number? How do we pick that? The technology now is such that we can pick that up, providing we can get rid of the background noise. And our theory or hypothesis is that these proteins did not exist before they became aggressive and invaded the...
Didn't exist.
Didn't exist on the cell surface. So they had to be produced by the cancer cell to make it much more aggressive.
Right.
And I guess there is one analogy that we have that we haven't been able to explain before, and that is babies in utero. For instance, why doesn't a mother's immune system attack a baby, right? Because the baby's immune system is completely different to the mother's.
Right.
The mother's immune cells do actually get into the baby. So we're not sure why, up to now, no one's been able to work out why babies aren't rejected by their mothers, right? So that's one of the things...
Wow, that's going to be a... Far out. That's a.
Well, this is the connection. This is what I think is the connection between aggressive cancers that we associate. Most of us associate cancer with cancer that kills, but there are cancers that actually you can live with.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's the ones.
Prostate is one of those.
Low-level breast cancer, for instance, you can live with for many years. Low-level lymphomas, you can live for many, many years without treatment. You know, so there are patients that don't need treatment. Leukemia, for instance, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, you can have that condition. Up to now, people thought that they were different diseases. In other words, it wasn't aggressive cancers by the mutations inside them. What we've discovered, and we're about to publish this soon, is that in these well patients with CLL, or chronic lymphocytic leukemia, for 20 years, they have as aggressive mutations as the ones that actually have the disease.
Yes, got it.
So up to now, no one's actually been on the same wavelength there. So what we then thought of was that there must be something else. There must be another way the immune system controls the cancer to keep it from causing disease.
This is in the people that have got it but are still alive, or yeah. It doesn't seem to be. So how far down the track? So is this your next realization?
Right, yes, this is what we're doing right now. And for the first time, we've identified positive phage clones. In other words, these are only present in the diseased CLL patients, not in the CLL patients without disease, and not on any normal cells. We haven't been able to detect it on any normal cells whatsoever.
So remarkable is this in the world or research of cancer?
Well, this is really quite remarkable because the technology to find new proteins has always looked at finding proteins that are increased in amount. In other words, you can pick it up by showing a gene is there but it's actually increased in intensity or goes down in intensity. So a lot of the technology and a lot of the gene approaches has been looking at up and down regulation of genes, right? And what we're working on is a completely new protein that wasn't there before. And why was it missed by a lot of other people? We think it's actually a very, very small protein. And secondly, it's not in the large numbers. In other words, it's very potent. And it's the same reason for why we think embryos have the same proteins that are on the surface. Every single cell in the embryo has to have it. And then as soon as the baby's born, we think those proteins are switched off completely. Otherwise, the immune system won't be able to get rid of any cancers or any...
Professor George Kanarakis, this small research facility on the first floor in a building in Ballarat, it's fair to say that you and the facility are ahead of the curve universally with finding a cure on the cutting edge. It's just amazing that you must be regarded by your peers.
I'm a bit more cynical of all of this because being a scientist, of course, you have to be cynical about any obvious discoveries. But we haven't actually... The way I'm thinking is that the thing that fascinated me is how can you have cancer and be well, right?
Yep.
That's the thing that's always fascinated me. It's one of the things that my colleagues didn't want to see patients that were well because they weren't having problems from it. But I was...
No money in that.
Well, no, it wasn't that. It was the fact that I was fascinated by why did these patients have so much cancer load, right? And yet... For years and years and years, they didn't have any symptoms or disease. And that's the thing that led me to this thinking that we may have missed a protein that is only present. It isn't a protein that's there all the time. It's only switched on when a cancer... It's like a nuclear option for the cancer, right? Nuclear option meaning the last resort. That cancer is now going to not only destroy itself, it's going to destroy the person.
So are you recognised within Australia or are you frustrated?
No, I'm not frustrated.
You recognised within Australia?
Yes, I'm recognised as a cancer researcher. I have a professorship in Federation University in cancer research in cancer biology. We publish a lot of work internationally. We're recognised internationally. It's not so much the recognition that's important. It's the ability to do cutting edge research and find a way of doing it. If you have a vision, it's hard to get funding for this sort of project.
Yeah, but you need recognition to get funding, don't you?
Well, yes and no. Yes, you do. In Australia, the system in Australia is that you need to be part of a bigger group. It has to be a bigger institute, bigger group. All of that work is fantastic. We do cut above our weight in terms of our talent in science in Australia. I have no doubt about that. But to do these sort of projects where it's a 20-year project, right? So who's going to fund a 20-year project? There's no setup. It's the analogy I'm going to give you is the infrastructure of this country is funded on a political basis. Whenever there's a change of government, it puts money into whatever infrastructure they want. We should have a long-standing infrastructure committee that looks after infrastructure of this country, not relying on political issues. So the same thing applies for grants, right? So grants... I'm just telling you what I think is the same issues with granting. The granting is a 3 to 5 year turnaround. You've got to actually produce the goods, and you've got to do things that people expect you to do. It's hard to get innovative research going.
I mentioned earlier on the podcast, I just happened to tune into a thing on a bloke called Tesla, a scientist with regard to electricity back in the turn at the turn of the last century.
That's great.
And that frustration must still exist with scientists, even yourself today, that you're out there doing something which is a little left of centre or right of centre or whatever you like to call it, yet it must be terribly frustrating, but it's a problem that exists since time man was around.
In memoriam,
exactly. You know, the person who invented the polymerase chain reaction, Kerry Mullis.
The what, Prof?
The PCR reaction. You know, when you're having your COVID test, you do a PCR test. Yeah. Polymerase chain reaction.
I see. That's what that means.
Well, it took him ages to. No one believed him. Right. And so that went on and on. He never got funded for that research. He won a Nobel Prize for that. The people who worked out that stomach ulcers and duodenal ulcers were due to bacteria, you know, here in Perth, you know, Marshall and et cetera, they proved definitely that it was bacteria, Helicobacter, that caused ulcers. But it took 10 years for anyone. No, they never got funded. They never got their grants initially funded, but they proved it, and they got a Nobel Prize for it. But they never got granted funding for it at the beginning. So the same thing. You have something that is a bit out of the usual. You're not going to get funded in the same way. So you've got to find other ways of getting your research done. And that's why the Ballarat community has been very supportive. They've allowed us to do long-range projects. And I'm not saying we don't do short-range projects as well to show that we're actually doing... active research. We have, for instance, an ovarian cancer research program. We have a breast cancer research program. We have a bowel cancer. We have renal cancer. We have leukemia programs. We have a histiocytosis that we're world renowned in. So there's all these areas that we publish work on, and that is the currency of research.
Will this continue when you're gone?
Well, I hope so. I would hope that we set the institute up in such a way. Lady Potter was gracious enough to actually become our patron, and she's hoping to. Hopefully, we can hopefully get some acknowledgement of the institute here in Melbourne that we exist, and
we're hoping you can get some acknowledgement institute. We have quite a big lot of people that listen to this, but I'm not sure that they'll be in the funding. But if we could, I'd say I've never knew anything about this, and it was just so impressive to see that. And while you're trying to establish the protein or sort the proteins out or limit them down, the only form of fighting cancers these days is with chemotherapy and radiation, and the surgery, side effects of those debilitating.
There's immunotherapy. There's targeted therapy, there's immunotherapy, there's surgery, there's all of these are course therapies, right? And these are, of course, that's the only treatments we have available right now, and there's more and more being developed that are fine-tuning these areas. So there's no doubt that our improvement has, you know, in terms of treating cancer has definitely improved over the last 20 to 30 years. Particular last few years have meant there's certain cancers like melanoma, for instance, that would have had a death sentence for sure, metastatic melanoma, and now you can live for many years with melanoma now with immune therapies. Now, it's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about specific new proteins that are present on cancer cells that are unique and are there to evade the immune system. The way our current checkpoint inhibitors and immunotherapy work is that we stimulate the immune system to be really aggressive and just attack the cancer in a more general way. And
it has could this be done through medicine, do you think, or could this be done through a natural process, do you think?
Okay, so what's the end game of this? If we were able to discover these novel barcode proteins that are present in aggressive cancers and not in cancers that the body can live with, right? So this is the nuclear option that a cancer has at the last minute and says, I'm going to take over the body.
I'm going to invade you.
Well, if I do that, I know I'm going to die as well. So that's a nuclear option as far as I'm concerned. So most cancers try to find a way of how they can relate to the host and keep with the host, right?
Right.
That's evolutionary, what cancers would do. But when they push the nuclear option, that means that they then decide to take over the body. The body is going, that host is going to die. And as a result of dying, the cancer dies. Okay, so that's a nuclear option as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, in order to do that, it can't be a protein that's present there in all cancers. It can only be there as a last-minute thing that allows that cancer to become aggressive.
Right.
Okay, and that's what we're looking at. We're looking at new proteins, not proteins that were there all along.
So what about different cultures, societies, races, or whatever else? Is cancer, what you're doing, only relevant to what we call Caucasian or whatever, or is it throughout the world?
Throughout the whole world.
Even in
the animal system, the whole lot.
In Iceland or?
Everywhere.
Switzerland.
The whole concept. Don't forget.
Eskimos.
Yeah, animals. You know, everybody's got the same process going on. Now, it is true that we've been good at controlling cancer for a lot of patients, and by treating, even with breast cancer, for instance, stage 4 breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer, we're very good at using treatments to control the cancer so that we can allow some control of the immune system to attack the cancer.
Is your physical shape, whether you're obese or underweight or overweight or tall or short, does that have any effect on cancers developing or
generally? We know that there are risk factors, right? So if you're a big smoker, if you're a big drinker, if you're overweight, they're definitely all risk factors for certain cancers. There's no doubt about that. There's also the genetics that you inherit. And also the environmental factors that are there. There's chemicals, radiation, also viruses that come along. These are all things that cause mutations, right, in your genetic material. Those mutations, your body has to be able to control them and repair the damaged ones. Now, sometimes the damage is only minor and the cell survives, and that means the cell doesn't die. That cell then has the propensity to develop into a cancer the more and more mutations it develops.
On a philosophical argument, do you think cancers were put in our bodies? You just mentioned about animals and so on and whatever else. It has no barrier to say, we don't want you to continue inhabiting this world. You've got a certain amount of time on it. Now, if you get this cure, how long are we going to live as humans? Are we going to overpopulate this world?
That's a good question. That is a very good question in terms of, is this an evolutionary thing that we've been having to deal with? The problem with that is that I would agree with you in one way if we only see that in the aging population. You know, in other words, people who've had their long length of life and then get cancers. But unfortunately, I see children with cancer and I see young adults with cancer and well people with cancer, that we need to step up and do something about it, because the quality of life with somebody with progressive cancer is not good, as you know, and it is not from my point of view, I'm committed to trying to do something about it.
But
that's another philosophical question that you raised.
Very good question. So the equipment, I was just fascinated. Went in there, and the first thing you see there is the dry ice containers, and then
you see the liquid nitrogen.
Oh, liquid nitrogen.
It's very cold. It's much colder than dry ice.
Oh, sorry. Yep. Sorry. This is a layman's explanation. So liquid nitrogen, and then there was machines there that you said, or people said, cost millions of dollars. And
half a million anyway. When you add it all up, yes.
There's millions of dollars worth of equipment in that, and it's all funded by benefactors and
community.
Extraordinary.
How many other people are like you in Australia?
We're the only region.
No. Or how many people are doing research, I should say, like you in Australia?
Well, all I can tell you, Don, is what I know, what I do, which is in the regional area. So there is no other regional cancer research institute in Australia. They're all in major metropolitan cities.
But are there other people doing research in other things? Is there a bit of a thing, you know, a body or something? Are there other people doing research not only in cancer but in other areas are not being recognised like you?
I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's there's a lot of research that goes on that's not recognised. There's an incredible amount of research. In order to be recognised in research, you need a number of things. You need to publish to start off with. You need to publish your work, and so we do that, and so we're recognised for that reason internationally. You need to be able to attract funding to do your research. Now, it could be government funding, it could be grant money, it could be philanthropy, it could be donations, it could be a ball that the community has raised $160,000 last weekend that Sam was going to come but couldn't.
And Roland, my date, I was going with Roland Rocchicelli.
Oh, were you?
I was going to go with
him.
How
is Roland?
Well, he's a bit.
He lives in Ballarat.
He does, and he invited me up with Lady Primrose Potter to go over the facility, and we were going to go to the ball, but he couldn't find the appropriate ball gown to wear.
Okay, but listen, Roland, getting you back more sensible here, George, do you think, what worries me, I was going to say something else, which, being a lady, I won't. Australia going forward, I worry about our future because all we worry about, you know, what we're doing is exploiting our natural resources. Our cost of labour is so high and whatever else. Mm-hmm. If this was to get publicity and exposure and recognition, do you think in the future Australia could go down this track that you're doing in a more, and there's got to be more people like you so that we're able to exist internationally?
Yes. Well, innovation is our strength. Right, so we need to be innovative in Australia.
We've got to be recognised.
Yeah, but we have a small population, right?
Doesn't matter.
No, but that small population, in a big country with a lot of resources, we have to be so innovative to be able to utilise our resources, not only physical resources, but mental resources. And that means allowing young people with ideas to do their research, right? So give them freedom to do research.
This is what I'm saying. Should we go down this? You know, I'm worrying about the future. Like, we've got natural resources, which we expect, you know, gas, coal, or iron ore, whatever else. The natural resources, we can't compete internationally in a manufacturing way because our cost of living, our wages and whatever else. We've got agriculture.
We can intellectually, Don.
Beg your pardon?
But we can intellectually.
Oh, absolutely. We can innovatively. Here's a thing where we're going to utilise somebody's innovative skill, should you get recognised, so we can compete and exist internationally.
Yeah, so if we were able to produce antibodies to these novel proteins, for instance, if they are novel, which they are, at the moment we have every evidence to suggest that those phages are picking up proteins that were never there in normal cells, never there in the diseased patient cells before they, in the non-diseased patients, in other words, like leukemia patients. Why are we using leukemia? It's the easiest sample to get from patients with multiple samples. I can't, for instance, biopsy your prostate, you know, every 6 months to get cells. I can take blood from patients. They've given permission to do that as part of our tissue banking. And that's how we've made an inroads into this area, right? What's the innovativeness of that? It's the foresight to see that having those samples for 20 years is going to come to some pay dirt at the end, right? Now, who would fund that project at the beginning?
Well, this is what
I've put in 10 grants at least on this work. Every single one got knocked back.
So Don.
Yes, I understand the frustration, but we've got to go down this track if we're going to exist in Australia internationally.
Correct.
So in our own naive way, Don, I was impressed, like you are, with what's going on up in Ballarat, and that's why I asked the professor to come down here.
So what do you want, a pat on the back?
No, not at all, Don, but what we're trying to do is, through our limited audience of people who might, is to be a benefactor. Like, if you wanted to be part of all this, and if there might be one person in the 60,000 that listen to us a week, I think 60,000 listen to us, if there's one person They could get in touch with the Ballarat Centre for Research, which was renamed in 2012 to the Fiona Elsie Cancer Research Centre Institute. The Fiona Elsie Cancer Research Institute. If there was someone like Stuart Gull, seriously, a great friend of ours and a great footballer.
Great
friend of mine. He's a friend of mine. Played golf with him.
Did he knock your block off when you played football?
Absolutely.
He could handle himself with a pair of boxing gloves.
Belted the living suitcase out of me, Don. A benefactor lives in Ballarat, is not only walking the walk or talking the talk, he's doing something about it. And if there was people who hear this and think, wow, I just never knew that was going on. And that's why I thought, well, it's not patting the back, whether we'd get the professor down to speak to us. And if anyone should be considered to be the Australian of the Year, it's people like the professor who actually do something to save family grief and health. And I've not impressed by many.
Well, you've made a profound effect, because I haven't seen him talk like this before, George, so well done.
Don, just to answer your last question about how do we use this, once we discovered these barcode proteins, how do we actually make them work for patients? You make antibodies to those proteins. Those antibodies are going to recognise those proteins on the cell surface of the disease cancer cells. They're the ones that are going to block the ability. They're the ones that are going to block the bad proteins on the cell surface. And they're the ones that are going to allow your immune cells. So the analogy is you have a fog around the cancer cells. They're invading your body. They're taking over vital organs. You have your immune cells sitting there doing nothing. The cavalry is sitting on top of the hill.
And you've got to ignite them.
And what you do is you get rid of the fog by using those antibodies, right? Now, can I just say that having a barcode stamp on each cancer, it doesn't matter where it's from, which organ it's from, you might have the same three proteins in the same order as somebody with breast cancer, somebody with lung cancer, or somebody with prostate cancer may have the same three proteins.
Yep.
Now, those cocktail of those three proteins is given intravenously as an intravenous infusion.
Got it.
And that's how we treat patients with immunotherapy. But this is not the coarse immunotherapy we're currently using called checkpoint inhibitors. This is specific, targeted precision immunotherapy only to that cancer for that patient.
Got it.
So this is a new way of thinking.
The interesting thing, George, I wonder if you'll just happen to stumble across this by accident.
Well, if you call looking at things...
Well, other things like Fleming and Flory discovered penicillin, and it goes on. They just happened to, by accident, discover it, having done all this research.
The more you practice, the luckier you get.
It's called serendipity, right? So serendipity is for the prepared mind. So in other words, if you have a concept of where you're going, you can't, for instance, you just can't look at these tiny little proteins in our current way what we currently have. But you have to have all these background checks of these cells beforehand to get rid of the background noise. So in some ways, yes, that is a bit of serendipity that we were able to have these patient samples, but getting those samples collected was the hard thing. Getting them into a liquid nitrogen storage, for instance, it costs $10,000 a month to keep the dewars going of liquid nitrogen. Now, we've had them for 22 years, so there's a lot of income that... in other words, which grants will actually provide for that sort of funding?
So, Don, I knew I was out of my depth.
You're not out of
depth. No, I am. I've understood 5% of what...
Well, I've tried to.
No, that's right. And why would we... I took a photograph of this. I knew I was going to be out of my depth when I saw this on the wall. This is a book which was in the professor's study. It said, viral and immunological malignancies. Who would write a book on viral and...
Well, the professor or George.
Who would read it and who would know what
it
meant?
Treaty probably
ruined it. I actually took a photograph of the book, Viral and Immunological Malignancies. Now, there's something to get your teeth into when you've got to sitting in front of your fire on a cold day. Don, this has been, I'm so glad that the professor eventually came down with his beautiful wife, Trudy. It's fantastic for you to come down, Professor George Kanarakis. You're so a star.
Can I ask
you
one
are
question
a genuine
we go?
Hero yeah. and star.
What? Trudy, were you a good runner?
I was a good runner.
Now, do
I was
you?
A better tennis player, Don. Don yeah.
So you inherited your father's genes as a good runner. Yes.
Well, that's good. You started on what car I drove Primrose Potter up in. You finished on whether Trudy was a good runner. And in between, we spoke to Professor George Kanarakis. Thank you so much for coming and doing this.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, Sam.
Good, George.
Because you ain't treating me right. Come back again.